Welcome to the Forbidden Apple Podcast, where we explore the relationship between queer people and religion.
They say faith can move mountains, and we want to know what faith means to you.
Join our conversation as we discuss overcoming prejudices, find common ground, and celebrate our differences. A former Orthodox Jew
and a Spanish-raised Catholic meet weekly and sink our teeth into
the Forbidden Apple.
The Forbidden Apple.
Hello, everybody, and
welcome to another episode of the Forbidden Apple. I am Pelayo Alvarez.
And I am Melissa Weiss. And today we will continue with our nuanced series.
Yeah, what is the topic for the day? What are we discussing in this nuanced conversation?
We are discussing comedy, the limits of comedy, the way comedy can be used for good, all things comedy.
Comedy can be used for a lot of things, right? And right now, I feel like our guest did a great job at pointing out the different limits, the different situations in which humor can be used for social change, and situations where humor is basically not really humor and just excuse to be a bigot once again. It's interesting to have like a look at that, those differences, and be aware of that when we do comedy.
What's the line? What's the fine line? How do we talk about topics that trigger people, but in a way that's respectful? What are the rules there? How do you navigate that? All of that. And we have a fantastic guest, which we're going to bring on soon.
I did want to ask you, what's your favorite joke?
I don't have a favorite joke, but I saw this joke. It's really a dad joke, but here we go. Today, I gave away my dead batteries. They were free of charge. Ha!
What did Winnie the Pooh say to his agent? Show me the honey. Okay, but let's get somebody who really knows how to do jokes, at least a little bit better than us. We have as our special guest, Caroline Berger, who is a comedian and also host of the podcast, Dyking Out.
She has some really, really, really good points, and it was really fun to talk with her. But before we start, here is a message from our friends.
I'm Brad Shreve. You know, not all queer novels or literary works are about romance or erotica. That's why I host Queer Writers of Crime, the podcast where I interview LGBTQ authors of mystery, suspense, and thriller novels. Each week, I dig into authors' personal lives and what makes them tick. Plus, each episode begins with my friend Justine giving a book recommendation. It's Queer Writers of Crime and available each week everywhere you listen to podcasts.
So thank you for being with us. Pelayo mentioned that he's getting into comedy. It's this conversation that we have at times because as we talked about, like, you know, the Pope, right?
With
this statement that he put out, Pelayo made this like comedy piece and he sent it to me. And we were talking about what are the limits? How much can you push? And so I want to know your opinion on the PC and comedy.
Yeah.
What are the boundaries?
Especially with a topic like religion, right? That affects people so personally that people have such a harsh ideas. And I mean, people have died for jokes on religion. So
right.
I want to like know, what is your take on this? What do you think?
My take, and you'll hear a lot of comedians say this, it's, is it funny? Mm. And if it's funny, then you can push it. The problem with that is that humor is very subjective. So what one person finds funny, another person will not. There are reasons why certain comedians can get away with joking about certain topics and others can't. Because if you make it funny, then it was like, okay, it was worth crossing the line to get that laugh. Or like you're like inserting some type of commentary or some kind of perspective that adds value. So it's like a laugh plus like, oh, you made me think about this in a different way. So this is funny and this is worth it. Where it fails is that a lot of times it's just not that funny, or like the payoff is not worth the setup, you know? And some people, you can tell they're just like trying to be edgy before they really can be. Now with religion, I'm reminded, like, before the pandemic, I saw a friend of mine and they did the Stonewall show too. And I was a little bit nervous because I had just done a show with them. And then they did the Stonewall show. And I was afraid that they were going to do the same kind of material where they're just kind of mean and dismissive about people who are religious. And to me, I'm like, but that's not funny. If you had like a really funny take on it, where even like the person who is religious can listen to that and laugh at themselves and be like, yeah, this is kind of a ridiculous thing that all religious people have in common. Good observation. This is funny. That's one thing. But to just be like, who's religious here? Okay, everybody with your hand up, you're an idiot. Like, that's not funny.
Yeah.
That's not funny. That's just like, what are you doing here? You just like made somebody feel bad. Everyone else in the room recognized it. And now they're all feeling uncomfortable because they're humans and they can tell somebody has just been like hurt or insulted, you know? Mm. Bill Maher years ago had a monologue. Again, can't say enough. Not a fan of Bill Maher. Very problematic. Not going to deny, though, that he has said some funny things in the past. And he did have this whole monologue about the Catholic Church, the priests that were molesting children and the church protecting them. I mean, it was funny, but it was also like really biting commentary and criticism, but told with jokes sprinkled in that just made it more powerful than somebody maybe with a bullhorn being like really angry and ranting about it. Mm-hmm. You know, comedy makes things that are like really tough a lot more easy to digest, and people are willing to think about these uncomfortable things if you promise to sprinkle it with laughs to kind of like diffuse what's so uncomfortable about it. But I remember watching this thing from Bill Maher, and my dad's girlfriend at the time, who like grew up in Massachusetts and was Catholic, I was like, Betsy, you have to see this. This is so on point. And it made her really upset. And she was like, I don't like that. So even then, where I thought like, oh, this is a great example of that, she's like, no, I don't like it. This makes me uncomfortable. This crosses the line. He went too far.
Yeah. I mean, comedy does that, right? Comedy crosses lines, and comedy is also used for social change, like you're mentioning. I think like at this point where we are right now, you may offend people without even knowing, right?
You may cross certain lines.
You will. That's 100%.
Yes.
So how do we filter that? Like, where do we stop?
I'm so worried about offending people or saying something wrong. I play it too safe. And I think it stunts me as a comedian, but I'm just so afraid of like something I try out or say, and it gets like taken the wrong way, or somebody really like jumps to a conclusion and runs with it because of the internet, like Twitter culture and the pylons. Things get out of control and people distort the truth very easily. And you can say one thing and then somebody will take it three steps further from that and be like, well, if they said this thing, then they obviously truly believe this.
Uh-huh.
And then it's like, whoa, 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 that's not what I said at all. But all context and nuance has been taken out of it. And then all of a sudden you're just getting like dragged, and it's a nightmare. And I've seen it happen to people. There's a lot of debate about cancel culture and people saying, well, there is no cancel culture. It's just consequences. It's like, yes and no, because I think it's getting conflated and cancel culture gets thrown around on a lot of things. It does not. Like if you rape somebody and you get canceled, like that's consequences. That's not cancel culture. That's like, oh, you did bad things. And now people are choosing to like put you on blast, rightfully so. There are instances though of people who, you know, have their Twitters searched for tweets from like 10 years ago or something. Yeah. And a lot of comedians, when they start out, they do try to be edgy because they're trying to find their voice. There was a comedian who explained this when it happened to Megan Amran, just a super funny comedy writer, big fan of her comedy. Somebody dug up this summer a couple of tweets from her past. And one of them was like clearly in poor taste. It was a joke that like it misses the mark. It wasn't worth it, the payoff, but it was from like 10 years ago. She got off Twitter for like months because of it. And like people piled on. And then somebody, one guy who piled on, this comedian, Brian Yang, he started like being like, oh, she's been so nice and awesome to me in person. But now that I see this, this is unacceptable. She has to explain, but like going off, even though she immediately apologized and people are like, that apology isn't good enough. And it was like a very sincere apology. It was like there was nothing she could do to make this better. So she had to go offline. Meanwhile, this guy, Brian Yang, who I'm sure is a great guy. Then people went into his Twitter past and were like, oh, what about you? What about the? So then he starts getting crapped on and gets canceled. And then
this just seems like a mob of hate.
It's a mob of hate and people trying to take people down. When people are like, there is no cancel culture, I'm like, there are people who are losing their jobs for things that they did 10 years ago thrown into the context of today. And it was probably in poor taste 10 years ago, but you're like, a job is somebody's livelihood in this country. It's what you need to have insurance, and you're taking away somebody's ability to have health coverage and earn a living just to appease these mom. I'm like, why are we doing this to each other? This, it just feels very unhealthy.
Yeah. It also doesn't allow, like, you know, if I'm the same person that I was 10 years ago, that's like shame on me, right? You should be growing.
Right.
And you should be allowed to mess up and learn and grow.
Yeah. Oh, I'm constantly censoring and stifling myself and like tweeting out something and then like immediately deleting it. And I'm somebody with like I try to be like so conscientious and like, I don't want to hurt anybody. I want to be, you know, I always want to be on the right side of history and discourse. So I'm very careful. And even then I get like so paranoid about things that I'm like, well, I don't know. And if this gets taken out of context or whatever, which like happened to me recently and I just had to like delete it. It was just like a dumb joke about the...
I would love, Caroline, if you can tell us more about what happened to you personally, that joke that you tried and kind of like backfire, but let's do that after the break, right after.
Great.
Oh my God, I got a pedicure for only $50 that left my feet smelling like rose butter.
Well, I got a facial that like I am obsessed. It changed my face, like obsessed.
I just got $3, so I got the Forbidden Apples Patreon, and it really changed my life.
Change your life?
Yeah.
Okay, so like, how do I subscribe?
Oh, you just have to go to www.patreon.com/theforbiddenapple and sign up there starting at $3 a month.
Whoa, $3 a month. I'm on it.
So tell us, Caroline, what happened to you? What was your experience with that joke?
Yeah, so I made a joke the day of the storming of the Capitol. So I was, you know, seeing some of the stuff unfold like in the very beginning of it. And that day I actually had a podcast recording with a guest who lived in D.C. And I'm like, oh, I don't know if she's going to be able to record because things are getting kind of crazy. And I know she's around that area. And things are probably stressful. She's probably like not going to be like distracted. We're all kind of distracted. So I tweeted something along the lines of, this coup was all fun and games until it messed with my podcast recording. So it was just like the joke was like, all this stuff is going on, but I'm only thinking about me.
Yes.
Right. It's not a great joke. Somebody who has issues with me retweeted it and said, this is completely inappropriate and insensitive and flopped worse than your stand-up. So they like took a mean dig at me. Then people start retweeting that and being like something's seriously fucking wrong with this person. Like all these like mean things. It didn't go crazy, okay? But it, for me, it's like one thing like that. I'm just like, oh my God. Like I just like shut it down. So I just like blocked the person, deleted the tweet, even though like it was fine. But I had actually like we did cancel the recording for the next day. And then I'd gone out to like run errands. And then I came back and then looked at Twitter later that night and saw like all these notifications. I'm like, oh, no. And it made me feel awful. And that was just like such a, I think, a benign tweet. And that, so it's like people are willing to put you on blast and like check people you.
That becomes the issue. It's like this all or nothing thinking and how it's just it's bullying. That's bullying. Yeah.
It was definitely bullying. And I was kind of mad afterwards. I'm like, I should have left it up because I don't think I looked like the bad person in that scenario. I think the person who tweeted it actually looked like kind of a jerk. And maybe I should have just left it up and whatever. But then I knew that I would always like revisit it and think about it. And I just wanted to like get it out of my life. I think there's like two things to this. Like the censorship, which it's not really censorship, but like the need to self-censor. On one hand, I think it can make us more creative. And I think that it allows for a lot more like marginalized voices and different styles of comedy to flourish and for more like alt comedy to rise to the top rather than like traditional club comedy, which can be more offensive, doesn't uplift anyone. It's punching down and that kind of stuff. And So it is good in that it forces you like not to go for like the low hanging fruit. But at the same time, it's like if you are self-censoring so much and you're not going there, then like what kind of commentary are we missing? And Melody and I, when we record, we feel that every week we discuss things. It's like, oh man, when we said that, like how many emails are we going to get? How many people are going to be mad? There are people I want to have on the podcast, even having them as a guest is going to, we're going to lose support. We're going to lose patrons or something just because this person was deemed to be problematic at one point in a way that maybe I think was unfair. We've had listeners go and look at the comedy sets of past guests and be like, this person made a joke that I think is transphobic. How could you have her on the podcast? I'm like, I'm not watching every comedy set that every person does for the guest. I'm having on people that I'm like meeting in person and that I know on the scene. And like, yeah. And I don't want people coming and spewing anything that's like hateful or harmful or hurtful on my podcast. That's like definitely not going to happen, but I can't guarantee that everybody is like squeaky clean and free of past sins. And that one particular comedian on the episode talked about how she used to get physical with her past partners and people were very angry at that. But I kind of called her out on it. And then we had a conversation about it. And I'm like, those are conversations that people don't, what was I supposed to do? Kick her out of the room? No, I said, hey, there's never an excuse for that. That's not cool. And she's like, no, you're right. And I've gone to therapy and I've changed and I'm not like that anymore. And still we got so much hate for that episode for even like continuing to talk and laugh with this person afterwards. And like, what's going to become of humanity if we don't give people like some grace and room to grow and room to change and not feel like a world of shame for every bad thing that
that's
they've
it.
Done.
That's it's kind of like the new Catholic Church, right? Like it really creates a layer where you don't let people talk about these things, and surprise, these things are going to keep happening. So at least let's talk about it. Let's see how can we help people like move on from like their toxic traits that we all have.
And it's also, it's important conversations, and it's also important to see how you handle it, right? Like, I think that should be where, like, you know, being able to talk about the stuff, being able to handle it in a way, and the person owning up to it, and like, no, like, that's beautiful. Like, that should get only good. Yeah, that should only get a good response, but that's the same thing. Like, the shame, like you were saying about the shame keeps people from growing. So you're just, like, hiding it under the rug. Isn't that, like, what... you know, conservatism and like all that stuff. You're like, my parents used to hide things under the rug and we wouldn't like, you know, everything has to be perfect. And the church hiding pedophilia under the rug.
Right.
This is what our world has come to. It's like everyone has to be perfect and everything, you know, and anything bad that they have done ever, anybody has ever done, let's just not give them a voice.
And this is where it's like, take a cue from religion, and where you're allowed to ask for forgiveness from things. Yeah. And as long as you're sorry for it, you are forgiven. Like, that's a beautiful thing, you know, if you're truly sorry about it. And that was like the problem with, you know, everyone loves to talk about Louis C.K. Like, I never been a fan, thought that he handled everything the worst, you know, in a pretty bad way. And some people were like, there's like, good for him. There's nothing he could have done to like redeem himself in the eyes of some of these people. It's like, honestly, yeah, there was some stuff, because we know from his comedy that he has the ability to like look inward and be like, make very poignant observations about himself and to really recognize what he had done and turn it into something funny while acknowledging like, this was really bad, and you know, I did it because of XYZ, and like, what an idiot I am for it, and like, and decide to be very positive. Instead, he like leaned into like, okay, now I'm gonna make fun of kids who were involved in schools that had mass shootings. I'm like, what?
Yeah,
like that's where you're going with that? Like, no, like you could have really redeemed yourself by showing, like, accepting, taking accountability, accepting it and growing, but you didn't do that. So yeah, a lot of people are still angry.
But as you're saying this, right? My thing is like, yes, of course that's how it should be done. But you had a guest on and the guest talked about something, you called her out in it, you talked about it and you got hate. So
yeah,
really? Like, you know, if this person is like, so Louis C.K. thinking like, people are going to come after me anyway. I mean, not that it's the right way you handle it. I heard
I was like,
come on. But at the same time, would that help him? I don't, just for some people, yes. Right.
For other people,
it wouldn't. Yeah. And it would just be like, anyway, you're going to hate me. So like, I'm hate. And especially if you go into shame, because I mean, if you try to think about the psychology, but like, he may have gone into that shame place and been like, and now I'm just like, you know, and shame others because I hold all this stuff.
Right.
It's not it seems like this world, it's not the easiest time right now with the social media and with this cancel culture to really be able to mess up, say like, this is, I know I messed up.
Yeah.
You know, and people be able to hold space for that. It doesn't seem as available.
It's not. And what you're saying is exactly right, that I think he probably hedged his bets and thought, you know, I'll probably like, I doubt I can ever make this group of people happy because they've already decided that I'm like akin to a rapist, while I have all these supporters who love me anyway. So, and if I apologize and take it back and change my tone, whatever, they're going to be angry and they're going to be disappointed. I'd rather not disappoint the people who love me the most, who cares about the people who were quick to say I'm like this horrible human about it. And there was like this whole thing where Janine Garofalo was interviewed by, I want to say it was like Bustle's podcast or something. She was on a podcast. It was months after this all went down. And Janine was just saying, can we just like leave it alone? Can we just leave him alone? Do we have to keep like harping, just like leave Louis C.K. alone? I know him. You know, apparently he did some bad things. I don't think he's a bad person. Inherently, he's a dad. He has kids. This has gone too far. This is a little bit much. She took so much heat for that. And almost like more heat than him, because people are like, oh, well, we would expect that from, you know, a white man, but like Janine Garofalo, you should know better. And she was coming onto my podcast. I had asked her that week coincidentally to do my podcast, and she said yes. And then she was like, wait a minute, you're not going to ask me about Louis C.K., are you? And I said, no, like, I don't think it's one women's responsibility to have to, like, so many Terry Gross did this to Tig Notaro in an interview. It was supposed to be an interview about Tig's new comedy special, and Terry Gross kept wanting to talk about Louis C.K., and Tig Notaro didn't want to talk about it. And she kept being, I'm like, why does Tig have to answer for Louis C.K.? Yeah. Why does Janine have to answer for Louis C.K.? And you know what? Janine Garofalo is allowed to say, I don't think we need to keep piling on. That's her opinion. I disagree with certain things of it. I disagree with her maybe like downplaying what he did. That doesn't mean that she's bad. We yeah. can do, there's no room for disagreeing because yeah. things have become like so extreme yeah. and so inflamed on the sides so that there are some, yeah. And mm-hmm. there are some things where it's like, well, yes. Of, like, I can't imagine you want me to see eye to eye with racist, like yes. bigoted, hateful, violent people. I get that. There's a lot of people not like that in between. And yeah. we tend to go after the people who are more closely aligned with us. I don't know if it's because we're like disappointed with them or holding them to higher standards.
Yeah.
But I just know a lot of people who are like progressive and liberal who are attacked for doing so much less.
Yeah.
Than yeah. so many people. And it's a little scary.
For you in particular, do you have like a bubble of safety or like a space where you can kind of like run things by with other people before you like throw them to the public? Do you have like a support yeah, yeah, system yeah. that helps you to have these nuanced conversations?
Yes. Yeah, so that's what open mics are for in theory, which is why open mics are like so awful and so brutal is it's people testing the waters and it is a lot of like cis straight white guys who like want to see if they can use the N-word. And it's like, no, that's not funny. Like you're not being funny. And then you have to sit through that and you're like, oh my gosh, this is the worst to have to suffer through that. But that is kind of the space that is like kind of what is, and that's why people create a lot of mics that, you know, that are more what they call like safe spaces. I go to a mix of both. I go to mics that are like just for women and non-binary folks. I go to mics that are for LGBTQ folks. But I also go to like these mics where I know like the worst of the worst people are going to be there making highly offensive things. And you just kind of like wait through it. Because they're a little bit more reflective of an audience, you know, that you're going to get if you want to perform in yeah. more mainstream spots. So it definitely depends, but I'll say like the reason I know I censor myself so much is like some of the biggest laughs I have and some of the biggest laughs I get are with my friends in one-on-one conversations. Or I have this one straight male comic that I'm friends with, but we mostly just message each other and we will have jokes that, I mean, I would never, ever put out there, but they're the funniest back and forth. I have so much fun talking to this guy and we just take digs at each other and it's so much fun and it feels like so freeing to be able to do that and know that a line won't be crossed. And sometimes he gets close to the line with me and then I'll get close to the line for him and push it right back on him. And that's kind of like how comedians are between each other. But it is like very nice and free. Or even like Melody and I, the way that we talk off the podcast, we're like, oh my gosh, we could never make this joke on the pod. Or sometimes we make a joke on the pod and then we're like, yeah, we have to edit that out. People are going to be angry about it. But at the same time, I'm like, I hate to rob some people from this joke because it's like very funny.
Do you think so there are certain topics people have this idea, like certain topics you cannot talk about. You can't joke about rape, right. You can't joke about children, you can't joke about the Holocaust.
Right.
What do you think are their limits? You know, do you have to be part of a specific group? Do you have to talk from personal experience? How do you navigate that?
It goes back to like, is it funny? Because I've seen people who aren't gay make jokes about the queer community or have that in their material. I know that I saw Amy Schumer live years ago and she had some joke, like just telling a story and then made a reference to like a lesbian aunt and kind of did like an act out of this just like totally butch lesbian aunt being like really intense at a family gathering. And I thought it was hilarious. I'm like, yes, I'm sure you've had that experience with some butch lesbian aunt. Like, who hasn't? We all know what you're talking about. This is relatable. You're not making fun of it. You're just like painting a picture in this story, and I'm okay with it. You can kind of tell when it comes from a place of like mocking and when it comes from a place of love. There's just like so much nuance to it. They can do it in a smart way, in a way that's funny, in a way that they're not punching down is like the most important thing. But in terms of like, you know, like, oh, you can't make rape jokes. Well, I hear a lot of women who are raped who make rape jokes, and some of them are really good. Some of them you can just tell it's someone trying to process their trauma and find a way to laugh at something very traumatic, which is what a lot of comedy is. And it might not hit, but those jokes are harder to do. And sometimes you need to spend more time in comedy to do that well. I have a miscarriage joke. That's one of my favorite jokes. I've never had a miscarriage. A lot of my friends have. My sister has. It's my favorite joke. I'm not going to not tell it. I've told it in front of people who've had miscarriages, and nobody's gotten mad at me yet. So I'm going to keep doing it. Part of why jokes fail sometimes is that you're not getting enough buy-in from the audience. So on the premise, like sometimes you have a premise and I've seen premises where I'm like, I don't necessarily agree with that premise. Like you'll be like, oh, you know, everybody knows that vaginas smell like fish. And it's like, I don't think that's true. I've been in a bunch of them and I've never thought like salmon. Like, so I'm like, this joke is going to fail.
That was funny.
Because I'm like, this joke is going to fail because the thing you started with is not a truth. So I'm not on board.
Taking this back to, let's say, a topic that you want to talk about or highlight issues, yeah, but being able to do it in a way that's sensitive. How do you get the audience to be on board with you? Because you got to first, you all, it seems from what you explained, people have to be on board and like to start off, and then you earn the joke.
So, yeah.
Like, how does that work?
Yeah. So it does take time. So my humor, it is like more dark and edgy at times. So I do have to kind of like really think about it and learn from each experience and kind of like tune the joke a little bit every time. But there's one joke that I started doing around the time that things shut down with the pandemic. Did it, I think, at one of the last shows I did. And I really liked it and it got a good response. And then I tried doing it on a Zoom show around the time of George Floyd and the protests. And after I made the joke, I said, yeah, I know what's going on. I'm committing to that joke anyway. And I kept, and then that got like a huge laugh because it made people awkward that I was doing this joke. And I'll just say the joke, like it's this whole long bit about my grandmother having Alzheimer's, and that's how she died. And I said, you know, a lot of people, when they have a loved one who has Alzheimer's, they're afraid that that person is going to forget their name. Not me. I was afraid she was going to remember the N-word. But that's the joke. And it's a funny joke. And I've said it in audiences with people of all backgrounds, and they like it. It's relatable. Like, people know that is a thing that happens when people, yeah, get like old and senile. They say things, and then for the first time, you're like, what? Like, I never heard you say that my whole life, you know? And like at the place my grandmother was staying, like she had like a lot of the nurses there were Black. So that was a real fear of mine. I'm like, I hope my grandmother doesn't, in her like senile state, get racist with these ladies. Like, that's my biggest fear right now. And it was a real thing. And I present it in a way that's unexpected.
I feel like there's also two things. Like, one is that is something that is not generalized, that is about your experience, an actual fear that you had, and a person, something that you actually lived. And right. Second, you're really pushing down on racism in this case. So I think you're making, yeah, a fun about, if you were about like racist people instead of like pro yes, being pro racist. I feel like we have a lot of like good takeaways from this conversation. So even useful for somebody who wants to start in comedy like me.
Yeah, yes.
So I'll be taking note of it.
I think even if it's not careful. Comedy. Because I think this is in general, like it affects everything. It's like, how do you, right, think about, how do you come across in a way that's like people can take in a way that's not offensive, but talk about something that's sometimes difficult. Like, I think the advice can apply to just anybody.
Yeah, I think humor is so important. I think it's Judy Gold is a comedian. She has a book, and she did an episode of Diking Out. The book is called like Yes, I Can Say That, and it's about PC culture. And it's a funny conversation because I was like trying to challenge her on some of the things that she said in the book, in a nice way, but that I kind of disagreed with. Because she was saying things like, you know, like right now it's like the most like dangerous time to do comedy, or like it's, and I'm like, well, no, not really, because all like now we have so many more like women in comedy, so many more LGBTQ, so many more racial minorities that are participating. So now it's like a really cool time in comedy. Like, yes, is this other thing heightened? Yeah, but that's only like a piece of the story of what's going on in comedy right now. And she agreed with that. So I don't think any topic is off limit. I think it's how you talk about it. And what are you really trying to say? And if you don't know what you're trying to say when you're making a joke, it's probably going to fail.
Where is your comedy going? What do you have lined up that we can share with our listeners? Any projects, any things coming up?
You know, with the pandemic, I haven't been doing much stand-up, just some Zoom shows. It's mostly been the podcast, Diking Out. And but I'm hoping, you know, when things are safe, I'm going to be doing more stand-up again. And it was unfortunate before the pandemic, I was supposed to be in a festival in Alaska. Then I was going to like Vegas. I had shows in LA. You know, I had a bunch of dreams and hopes that I'll
they'll come back.
In the meantime, everybody can go to listen to your podcast, Diking Out. I love what you do, Diking Out. I love what you do. And we were so excited when we went to see the show. And to be honest, I hadn't seen, I know, you know, Cameron Esposito and Rhea Butcher, they used to do together.
Yeah.
But you don't usually see just like, you know, two lesbians or however you identify. Just getting up and doing that. It was a first time experience for me, only time I've ever had that experience. And I thought that was fantastic.
You know, it's funny, queer people, lesbians especially, and Hannah Gadsby, I think, talks about this in Nanette. I think it made the Netflix special too, that performing for lesbians specifically can be very hard. And when I ask comedians to do my show, sometimes they're not that excited. At first, they're like, oh, cool, because it's at Stonewall and that's an iconic place and I'd like to perform there. But oh, my God, audience full of lesbians. Like when a lot of the PC cancel stuff goes on, people are like, oh, everybody's a snowflake. Like, you should try doing a show in, you know, the middle of Montana. I'm like, yeah, that's an easy audience. Like, I can talk about, you know, I can make jokes about toast and people are going to laugh. Try making a room full of lesbians laugh. That's the challenge. But actually what people tell me afterwards is they're like, that was awesome. What a great audience. How did you get such a great audience? Because they don't expect it from queer women. And I've asked some people about that. I'm like, you know, have you gone to other shows? And most of them are like, I normally don't go to comedy shows. Because I know there's going to usually be some dude that says like offensive stuff. I'm not going to find him funny. And to even sit through that for 10 minutes is a horrible experience. But Diking Out at Stonewall, I know that I can go there and nobody's going to be like punching down, you know, for the most part. Everybody's going to be coming in with jokes that meet the occasion. And it's going to be fun. And I'm not going to feel nervous or awkward or bad about it. And I'm not going to get made fun of for being like a butch lesbian in the front row. Nobody's going to call me out and be like, oh, is this your girlfriend? You two fucking, you know, which you see at other clubs.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
This has been great.
This has been lovely.
Talked to you for so long.
Yes. I'm glad we got to do it. This is fun. Yeah. I love talking about comedy.
Thank you, everybody, for listening. This has been another episode of The Forbidden Apple. I am Melissa Weiss.
I am Pelayo Alvarez.
Have a wonderful day.
Bye-bye.